Okay. Hope. I'm sorry, I figured this thing out. So this is Hope Sasko, the curator of the exhibit, and we wanted to do about a 10-minute talk here, and then we'll move into the other room and talk with the panelists as well.
Sure.
So take it away, Hope.
Thank you, and welcome everyone. I'm so excited to have a great crowd this afternoon, and I'm really excited to talk with some really distinguished and fascinating panelists. So I will try to keep myself to 10 minutes because I tend to get really excited and carried away when I talk about this exhibition. The exhibition that we're standing in right now is called Body Bodies, Satires of Unruly Women, and it came about when my co-curator and I were sort of talking about representation in 18th century, and I know British satire very well. I've written a lot about it and studied it in great depth, and I've really noticed, as did my co-curator, that there was something really unusual happening in images that dealt with women. So we have, you know, a catalog of many, many images in mind, and Cindy and I kept on coming back to this fact that there's something a little bit different that was happening in representations of women who were gaining new prominence in the 18th century. So we decided to explore it with this exhibition. So on the walls, we have about 28 print satires from the mid to late 1700s. I think there's actually a few from the early 1800s that in some way talk about how women were represented and viewed in 18th century society. And in London in particular, I should also note that this is a very, very much a British phenomenon that we're sort of surrounded by. The wall, and I will encourage everybody to come and take a closer look, but the wall that I'm standing in front of has three prints on it that were really selected to get to the kind of humor that we were seeing in the types of engagement. So the first print sets the tone for the show, and it shows a figure called a bawd. Raise your hand if you know what a bawd is. Is anyone? A few people are familiar, but it's kind of an out-of-fashion term these days. And a bawd is really associated with running prostitution houses, and they are in charge of going out and finding the young women that will be corrupted into prostitution. And so they're associated with physical pleasure, finding physical pleasure, and oftentimes bawds in the 18th century in particular are depicted as prostitutes past their prime. So there's this association with physicality and also kind of carnal knowledge. So that really, for us, set the show, the tone for the show, because we really wanted to explore the physicality of these representations of women and the way in which surface cosmetics became a way to indicate interior personality and interior and individuality. So there's a conflation of surface and interior in these images. There's also a kind of delight in the overflowing obese body that we see in a lot of these images that this is associated with women in particular as bodies that consume culture and fashion and all kinds of pleasures of the 18th century. So that is definitely going on in this image. If you take a closer look, you'll see some of the dynamics. The center image features Queen Charlotte, who is then Queen of England, being really torn apart for her political involvement. So some of the images will deal with women who are involved in politics and the way that their intellectual involvement is really kind of distilled down to the level of physical attraction and physical representation. So that's certainly on view. And then the final image at the end of the wall is an image of the Blue Stocking Club, which imagines a world in which women who gather together to have intellectual conversation and talk about reading and all kinds of intellectual pursuits are immediately turned into these brawling, masculinized creatures, and really critical of the impulse or the interest in self-education. So we kind of have three general images. As you're looking at them and the images in this room in particular. I want to point out that these are all images of women that were drawn by men. The women had no recourse when a satire was published. For example, the satire of Queen Charlotte was actually purchased by her son. So it went into the Royal Family Collection, which is now housed in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. So it was not seen as something that you could, should your image come up in this fashion, that you could really address or answer to. So there's a lot of, really kind of interesting play there. A lot of these women were well-known social figures, so they had some control over their public image in the terms of high art portrait painting. So there is sort of a higher level that these, higher level of artistic hierarchy that satires are responding to. But they're really, in a way, taking apart the very calculated public image that a woman might choose to represent herself. And I'll point you down to the end of the wall on the last three prints on the blue wall are of a very famous woman named Lady Diana Beauclerk, who was a great intellectual, became involved in political activity, and was really, in the images, transformed into somebody who was sort of like a sex-crazed aristocrat who wanted to be involved in politics so she could consort with people of lower classes in a highly sexually charged way. So she was a very prominent woman who really worked hard to construct an image as a writer, a musician, and was depicted in satire in such a way. So there's a way in which to understand what's going on in these images, we need to kind of keep that high art level in mind, and that's what the gallery monitor on the other end kind of hopefully points to. So I think our time is up in here, but I encourage everybody to take a quick peek. Do notice how really beautiful the printmaking qualities are. They're gorgeous images. And a lot of these artists were involved in producing images that addressed oversights of political power and were very critical of the monarchy. So they're using a very refined technique in a lot of ways to, in the case of women in particular, express a very conservative agenda. And I think that's something we're not always used to thinking about in satire, where satire often speaks truth to power, but here it's kind of mobilized to uphold some sort of power structure in place. So if you'll follow me and grab your seats, we'll begin our conversation.
Hey, Amy, how are you?
Good.
You got a thinking of the
story. Okay. Everybody really enjoyed it.
Oh, so. Not really.
Yeah,
it's small. Space.
Thank you. Okay. It was great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Record you.
Oh,
I'm
sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe
whatever
you want to do.
I'm not
going to
have to go.
Don't worry. How many people are present? Is it? There's one PowerPoint and one. Okay. Who's the PowerPoint?
Amy.
Amy is doing the PowerPoint.
Great.
Yes.
Yes. So we have that. If you want to let us know when to advance the slide, one of us can try. If that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Duchess, the Keira Knightley movie?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
The Duchess of Devonshire and her relationship with James Fox. She satirized a bunch of those.
Oh, yeah.
I was under the impression, having seen the piece, that she, Fox, in the weeks was sort of pro-abolition for the time. Leftist party. It could be that it's overstated.
So it looks like everybody's got a comfortable seat. Let me know if you have trouble hearing. I will try to project myself, but if you can't hear me in the back row, give a wave. I am really pleased I'm just going to briefly give names and I'll let you all say something a little bit about yourself.
But I'm really pleased to have stand up.
They can't hear.
They can't hear in the back.
Okay, should we kind of take turns?
Yeah.
Okay.
No microphones.
Are we going to have microphones?
No microphones, okay. I don't think. No, unfortunately not.
Okay.
So I'm joined on the table, well, I guess not stage or dais today, by Amy Fox, who, yeah, please wave.
Hello, everyone.
And would you like to
sure.
introduce yourself and let us
know? Sure. Hi, I'm originally from Boulder, so it's nice to be back for this. I'm primarily a playwright and a screenwriter. I live in New York, and I teach at NYU in the grad film program. I'm really excited to be here and see the exhibit. I think that I don't have an art history background, but I am engaged very much in the conversations around women in the media, how they're depicted, the stories and images we see of women in film and television specifically, and on stage. So that's kind of my perspective today.
And then Pu K.
Hi, my name is Pu K, and I had a dance company, and I also make films using the performers that work in my dances, and they're usually films that are in relationship to the dances that I make.
Anita Sarkeesian.
Hi, I'm Anita Sarkeesian. I run a nonprofit called Feminist Frequency, where we look at the way women are represented in popular culture. So we make videos on YouTube that are free and available and take what is often difficult feminist theory concepts and make them accessible for a wide audience with humor and pop culture.
And at the end, Willow Wilson, please.
Hi, I'm Willow. I'm a novelist and comic book writer. I write primarily superhero comics, including the best-selling series Ms. Marvel for Marvel Comics, as well as various other books.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining. I think it's going to be. I see some hand signals that you might need to.
Project.
Really project.
Oh, maybe we should just come in front and speak in front of the audience.
When you speak, just
come up.
No,
okay. Because then I could actually move the projector by hand closer.
Sure. Sure. Well, I'm really curious. One of the ideas in the show is that conflict between surface and interior, and I'd like maybe that's a good place to start in terms of female representation.
Say that again.
Just
surface.
Can we have the lights on unless we need to have the projection so we can actually see each other?
I'm afraid because of gallery conditions and the need to protect the photos on the wall, the light levels are set and we're not able to change them. We don't have like a light switch or a dimmer that we can raise and lower. So we are unfortunately bound by our conditions as a museum. I'm sorry. We'll try to project and be as visible as possible. And I'm wondering, Amy, do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure.
You were nodding, so I'm going to pick
sure.
on you.
In a way, I feel like Anita should start because I just feel like you have maybe the broadest reference point for what we're.
I'm sure you have brilliant things to say.
From my perspective, I think that what is interesting to me is because through my own work and through my teaching, I'm sort of at a point of intersection between art that is being created, specifically film and television that's being created. With women roles, female roles, and then also sort of the mainstream Hollywood system and what that system, the limitations of what that system is willing to represent about women. And I sort of work within that system and also outside of that system, and so I see the pressures from both sides. And so it's intriguing to me, just looking briefly at the exhibit, I feel the ways in which these every time these women step out of their prescribed roles, right, whether it's motherhood, domesticity, that they're not supposed to have opinions, that they're not supposed to be politically engaged, the imagery kind of takes over and attacks them for that. And I think that's really interesting. I mean, I think that what's, you know, I work in this visual medium of film and television, but the images that we see of women on those screens are such a ridiculously narrow version of what the female body is, as we know. And I think that presents a lot of challenges because unless if you're making your work totally independently, which means that you're raising your own financing and your audiences are going to be quite limited, you could display the female body, embody the female body in your characters or the roles you're writing in a variety of ways. But as soon as you try to enter that system of funding, distribution, the movies and television that actually make it to the screens that everyone here might see, you sign this contract, basically, that you're not going to show women without a certain body type. And so that's really my experience, and it's an interesting one. And just to share a few personal things around that, I have this film, Equity, that they're gonna show at the festival on Thursday. And the idea of that film is visibility of women in roles we haven't seen. So it's specifically about women on Wall Street, which is a very specific group of women, but a group of women we have never really seen in any of the very successful Wall Street films. So the producers of the project had that impulse, knowing some of those women themselves, knowing that those stories of those women working in that male-dominated space had not really been seen, and yet Wall Street movies are a very popular and successful genre. They had the impulse that we should create this film about those women. And so we did that. And in some ways, it increases visibility for women whose stories haven't been told. On the other hand, the two women who were the producers were also in the film. They happened to be white. They happened to be very thin. They're actresses. They've made their careers off their looks. And they were raising the money to produce the film, and so they were sort of guaranteed two roles in the film, two major roles. So that really limited for me and the director how the women of this film might look to an audience, right? So we then had a slightly more open situation for casting our lead, who is Anna Gunn. We're proud that Anna Gunn, I feel, among actresses, has a non-typical body type, and really owns that very proudly, and you know, we felt strongly about that, but still she's white. So the face of the movie doesn't necessarily reflect the diversity of values in some of the creators behind the movie. Interestingly, we had Q&As about the film, mostly respectful, mostly really progressive, interesting conversations, but at one of the very first ones, a man asked why we cast a fat woman as the lead in the film. Right. So someone still considers that a socially acceptable thing to say in a film screening, right? So that was a very disturbing moment. The other thing I just wanted to speak of is, and so I feel with my students tend to be, they're graduate students, but they come from all over the world. They come from really diverse backgrounds. They want to tell really authentic stories, and it's very hard sometimes to try to talk to them about what they're going to encounter, the pressures they're going to encounter when they take this work that they're largely self-funding and that's only being seen at small film festivals. If they want to succeed in this business, are they gonna have to start making compromises about the types of physicality that we see on screen? So that's something I'm interested in. The only other thing I wanted to kind of address today was just about visibility. I think that for women who are in so many ways relegated to the domestic sphere, kind of out of sight even today, we've seen those pictures, right, of the Trump administration signing those bills, and it's all men around the table. So I think that in some ways, the idea of just visibility, just putting female faces and bodies of all kinds out there is in itself a powerful action. And I just wanted to share some work of a photographer who I've gotten to know. This is actually, mine is the PowerPoint.
You need a different program.
So there's a photographer named Jody Christopherson, who's a very young, interesting photographer in New York. And she's taken on a project called Necessary Exposure. And it's her response to the fact that there are so few female playwrights being produced on the New York stages. And whenever that is raised, you hear certain artistic directors saying, well, where are these female playwrights? I'm not seeing their plays. They're not coming across my desk. They don't say that as much anymore, but that's what we used to hear a lot about 10 years ago. And so this woman started photographing these women, and she does these exhibitions where you see the faces of the playwrights on one floor, and then you go down the stairs and you actually hear excerpts from their plays, but you don't see them, right? So to kind of call attention, so you hear actors reading the work, but you call attention to the invisibility of these women on the stages. Her more recent works have gotten increasingly political, so I just wanted to share a couple. So this is my favorite one. So she actually came to some of the women she was photographing right after the election and said, I want to take a picture of you in whatever way you want to respond to the election. So this is my favorite one. It's a playwright named Leah Winkler. And she said, I want to flash Trump Tower, take off my shirt and stand there, and I'm going to write on my back, if you can't see, it says, do and say whatever the fuck you want in your art. So I find this to be a pretty extraordinary use of the female body in a piece of protest initiated by the photographer and the subject. She actually has these available as postcards to send to your reps if you want them. So you can look up Necessary Exposure. And then there's a few more that I think are also very powerful. So this is a Latino playwright named Hillary Bettis, and this is what she wanted to represent. I'm not going to explain it for her. The image kind of speaks for itself. This is another really interesting one. And then the last one I brought forward is, for those of you who know, there's this wall in Union Square Station in New York that's been covered with Post-it notes since the election, giving hope and speaking out. And so this woman decided she wanted to bring her yoga mat and pose in front of that. So I just wanted to share those with you as an idea, kind of in contrast to this exposition, how women today who are thinking outside the box may have some agency around the way that they're represented to create images like these.
Okay, we're going line.
We'll go in line. Okay. I think you have a video too, so while we've got the screen running.
Okay, I am a choreographer who works with movement that is outside of cultural definition. It's more about human potential. And as a result, I require certain intellectual and physical gifts of my collaborators, who are the dancers. I just want to show a little segment of a woman really pushing the boundaries of movement. And then I want to talk about how seeing the show makes me think that in some ways I'm like a body bot. I am, you know, I have to pick bodies, and then in a way they're being consumed. It's a little disturbing. I feel somewhat, and part of being a performer is dealing with the gaze. I mean, it's just intrinsic. You are being looked at, and you are being looked at for different reasons. So anyway, I want to show you Ginger doing this phenomenal piece of dancing. I'm sorry about the quality of the video. It's being it's from a VHS. So I find myself in the uncomfortable position, sort of culturally, of recruiting people because of, not only, but because of their bodies, and of course, because of their intellect and their mind, which is more important. But nonetheless, it is a very tense place to be when you're presenting bodies that are doing things that are not about being exploited. There's a contradiction in the act of presenting a performance, because you have made a choice. And I make this particular show has really made me very uncomfortable thinking about this. I mean, I think about how when we were rehearsing this dance, there was a retinue of composers that I was working with, John Zorn and Pat Irwin, who is the composer of this particular music, who used to come and watch the rehearsals. and other men, other composers, and I felt like I was running a cat house. I mean, it was, and these are my friends sitting there gazing at these women who are performing physical roles that are totally outside of the paradigm of femininity or of sexuality. And I think that inherent contradiction is in all media, is present in the very act of looking at something. You are projecting something that you need from that subject, the subject of your gaze. And the very act of being the person that is being looked at in a way is pandering to the need to be looked at, or to the need of people to be able to project their own life experience, their own needs, and what they're looking at. Like, I look at this because I want to feel physical liberation. And so you are looking at that, this woman moving, because that is what you need. And even though it may be a noble concept, it's still a slightly perverse act of consuming and projecting, objectifying. So I'm not really sure there are places, public places, where that isn't always the dialogue. So that's mine.
So it's hard to stay speaking at a high level for a long time, and we just start to go down a little bit. So just signal to us in the back if we start doing that, or if you can't hear us. So I guess this is just, I love how different all of the like ways that we're all interpreting this work is. For me, my initial reaction was about the way women are harassed online currently. Because one of the facets of feminist frequency is that we advocate to end online harassment, which began because I was the target of a massive online harassment campaign in 2012 that has never stopped. Mm-hmm. And there are many facets of online harassment and many strategies and tactics that are used. So everything from trying to knock your website offline, to death threats, to bomb threats at events that I speak at, to reporting me to the IRS and the FBI, which I still think is hilarious. I can't imagine the like report, the people getting those reports being like, a feminist on the internet is somehow a threat to the public good. One of the strategies, so there are many strategies, and I'm happy to talk more about online harassment, but one of the strategies that mostly men use against women and marginalized folks online when they're attacking them is to create caricatures of us. And they do this both in language, I'm sure you can imagine the caricatures of what a feminist is, right? Where we are all lesbians, which I don't know why that's a problem, but we're all man-hating lesbians that don't shave our legs and don't, you know, we're all ugly, et cetera, et cetera. We all want female supremacy, et cetera, et cetera. So they do work to try to demonize and minimize our efforts to change the status quo. The other way they do it is through visual medium. And that takes the form of, it takes many forms. So there are cartoons drawn of me being raped by a video game character. They take images of me that are online and add like profane images to them, like they draw on top of them. This is really gross, so trigger warning, just preparing you. They print out photos of my face and then ejaculate on them and then take photos of that and upload that. Which is really gross the first three times you see it, and after that it's like, oh, it's just the internet. Yeah, it's really nasty. And one of the other things that they do is they build these caricatures. So the internet is incredibly anti-Semitic. So they will, I've seen forums where they go after women who they think are Jewish, and they do that really gross, like, facial, like, you are Jewish because you look this way, and they'll do, like, comparisons of other women who, like, it's really horribly racist. It's called, I'm forgetting what the word is. Anyways, so they will draw, they'll draw caricatures of us in those old, like, the old anti-Semitic caricatures.
The big hope.
Yeah, right? And so regardless of my, whether I am or not, it's horrifying. And so this is very much that, right? These are what, 18th, 19th century caricatures of women who stepped out of line to some degree, who spoke up. Now, one of the things we were just talking about is the conflict that I have looking at this is, I love using satire to challenge power, right? I think that's really valuable and really important, and it is a legacy that activists before us have passed down and that we use today. But why does challenging power have to be reduced to sexism and racism and homophobia and all of those sorts of things? So I don't want to take up too much time because I think that the conversation is much more interesting than us just sitting and talking, but I just wanted to put that out there in terms of this is a thing that happens today, right now, that attacks people, like marginalized people online.
Can you say how you got to that place where they're doing this to you? I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, of course. So in 2012, I launched a Kickstarter campaign, which is a crowdfunding platform to make a series of videos that would look at the way women are represented in video games. The audacity of talking about a male-dominated sphere, I don't even need to explain it anymore, then descended upon me, and they just harassed me endlessly for years, and they still do.
Oh, wow.
Mm.
That's congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
So you really are this exhibit.
Yes.
Hello. So I'm seeing this installation for the first time today, and what was interesting to me and what struck me first going around and looking at all of these images is that a plurality of them, we'll find the cell phone eventually. That's all right. Is that the plurality of them show the female subjects with their breasts exposed. Mm. And sometimes they're exposed as being like these very, you know, sexually desirable, sort of, you know, perky, what we would think of as sort of classically attractive breasts. And in other ones, they are withered, old, you know, sort of falling victim to gravity, et cetera, like the one of Queen Charlotte. Mm. And it occurred to me looking at these that, man, how little has changed between the late 18th, early 19th century and today. All you need to do to humiliate a woman in public, particularly women who have dared to attain positions of power, is to expose her breasts. Every couple of months, there's a new scandal in which some enterprising person, usually male, has hacked into the private photos of some actress or other in which she is in various stages of undress, and disseminated these to the public. And I think it was, I don't remember which actress it was. This happens so often, sadly, that I get each scandal confused.
Jennifer Lawrence.
It was Jennifer Lawrence, thank you. Jennifer Lawrence, when this happened to her a couple of years ago, you might have seen her in The Hunger Games, and she's been all over the place, said this is a sex crime. And it was interesting that we'd never really thought of it that way before. I think we, all of us, had sort of been conditioned to think, well, why were you taking these pictures in the first place? Why does there exist photographic evidence that, in fact, sometimes you do not wear clothes? How dare you, you know, take a shower, get undressed. It was so interesting to me that that was sort of the immediate response, was like, oh, well, you know, what were you doing naked in the first place, young woman? And that's what struck me about so many of these, is that they're basically 19th century revenge porn.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In many, many ways, because it's the involuntary unclothing that is used, and I think clearly has a long historical precedent, to humiliate women in a very particular kind of way. In other words, in order to humiliate a woman in a position of power, all you really have to do is remind the public that she possesses a body. Mm. And that, to me, is very, very interesting. Mm. And of course, you know, we see caricatures of men in which, you know, they might, there's one over there in which, you know, there's a guy with kind of his butt out the window spewing poop at people. But it's often not quite the same. It's not sexualized in quite the same way. And that difference is very, very interesting to me. So what was most interesting to me looking at all of this was how familiar it is. is that it's two and sometimes, you know, 250 years old by now, yet at the same time it feels very contemporary. That really the slurs that we use to keep women in their place have not changed in that time, and in fact probably pre-existed all of these things by a goodly bit. So it's fascinating to see how little we have evolved in some sense when it comes to dealing with women using their power, their voices, in ways that we don't approve of. Yeah, so I'll just leave it at that. Because okay. I think I agree with Anita, the discussion is usually the most interesting. Thank you.
So one of the themes I heard from all four panelists in different ways is, and I think in the exhibition, I mean, thank you so much, first of all, because everyone has given me kind of a new lens to look at the show that I've been thinking a lot for a long time, and it's really refreshing for me to have a fresh perspective. But this idea of exposure, I think, is something the panelists have commonly commented on, and I'm really wondering about what sort of the multiplicity of images do and maybe how to combat it. So I wonder if maybe we could start with that concept or if there's any other themes that you all kind of want to interlocute each other as well. So
I was interested in how it was not just the women that were being exposed, but men also, like the image of the penis with the teeter board on it. I think, what does it mean when you show the naked body without its clothes? It's an animal. It's outside of culture. It's no longer constrained. And in some ways, it's all that nakedness, which is so, for me, joyous, despite the derogatory element of it, joyous about this period in time, which was really, really fertile with intellectual inquiry about the rights of women, the rights of humans, the experience of sexual pleasure. I mean, this is the time of libertinism. There was a dialogue in the culture that was about going outside of the culture to experience life. And so I think that the fact that it exists in the medium is really locked with that freedom that was intellectually happening at that time. And I was looking at some of those images, and they remind me of like Kim Kardashian, you know, the big butt, the big breasts. I mean, right now that we fetishize these. You can buy padding for your butt so it looks bigger. And a lot of young girls get butt enhancements. That there's a freedom involved in expressing the body that is seductive, and the fact that we're doing that now, perhaps it means that this is a time of great inquiry. Maybe we're pushing outside of the comfort zone of our, you know, American cultural paradigm. All right, that's what I would say.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think I'm sort of moved to share an experience that still really bothers me. And again, it's really in my alley of what I do, which is filmmaking and writing for film. But it's interesting when I hear your story and when you remind me of the idea that could be considered a sex crime. There's one experience I had, and I don't know why I share it other than to let you know the insipid ways that, because I feel like when you talk about that brutal, horrific stuff that's happening, that's in our faces if we look at it and we see that, and there's no question for many of us that that is wrong, right? But there's also these kind of insipid ways that this stuff comes up and you don't even see it as such. So I had a meeting shortly after my film came out. I went out to LA to have a bunch of professional meetings, and I was sent an article
and it's an article called Hacker is Watching. I don't know if anyone's familiar with it. It was an article, I can't remember who published it originally, but I think in The Atlantic maybe. But basically, it's a true story. It's about a guy who had hacked into women's webcams to watch them. And it's about how he was caught. It's about the FBI agents who tracked him down. It's about cyber stalking. And this particular man turns out to be sort of an interesting, in my mind, villain. Mm. Nothing's black and white, but as I'm reading the article, I'm assuming that this guy is the bad guy in the movie that's going to be written. And he turns out to have a really complicated past. He was from Mexico. His parents were gunned down in front of him at a young age. He then came to America to live with an aunt and uncle. He became a football player. Football seemed to have the potential to kind of take him out of his violent past. And then he was shot in a random shooting in his housing complex when he was a teenager and became a paraplegic. And then was so... had all this anger and was kind of shut in a house and couldn't work and started taking classes on hacking and all kinds of things and eventually found a way to hack into these women's webcams, and that made him feel powerful. It's a really interesting story and from a lot of angles, but when I went into this meeting, I sort of gave my take on it, which would have been to track the investigation of him and to sort of follow the FBI agent as who was the head of the cyber crimes in the FBI, and I was interested in tracking her and how her assumptions about who this person would be would change when she met him and learned his story. Everyone has their own take, and when you're interviewing for a writing job in Hollywood, that's what they want from you. They want to hear your take. And I went into a meeting, and it was with a man, but the production company, which I won't mention the name, but is owned by a woman who ends up on every list you see of the women changing Hollywood, the women promoting women in Hollywood, the women who are going to change gender parity in Hollywood. But this woman is always in the top five. She's one of the most powerful women in Hollywood. She was the boss. And the man I met with, I started to give my take, and he said, I'm going to stop you right there because I don't want to waste your time. Our take is that the hacker is the protagonist.
Is the what?
Is the protagonist. The
story. Mm.
Okay.
Yay.
Good. And I was really kind of stopped in my tracks, and I said, you mean the man who spied on these women and terrorized them online is going to be the hero of your movie? And he said, well, he's a really interesting character. And I said, yeah, he is a really interesting character, as are the women who he has stalked. And the power dynamic in this meeting was not in my favor. I was applying for a job, which I no longer wanted. But at the same time, I might meet with this company again. I wasn't at a point in my career where I felt like I could make a huge statement or so. I just sort of pushed back a little bit, and it was very interesting. And then when I challenged him, he said, "Well, we're look at it like Rear Window." Yeah, well, I mean, and it's just been astonishing to me. So I pushed back a little bit. I interestingly later had a meeting with Fox, who is going to be the studio making the movie, about something else. And they said, oh, did anyone ever talk to you about this project Hacker is Watching? I think you'd be a good fit for it. And I said, yeah, it was really disturbing. And I shared with them and why I thought so. And I said, whoever they've hired, if they bring you that version, I hope you will question it. But I guess for me, what keeps sticking out in my mind is that this woman who I, friends of mine who are really involved in the fight for women gender parity in Hollywood, continually post articles by the woman who owns this company that had asked that to be the take on that movie. And I just find that very insipid. And I just want us to question. Like, I feel like when we see something that's in our face, that's like those images or some of the things you described, it's so easy to call out what that is. But this is, it gets tricky, right? This guy was working really hard to convince me that that was the approach to take of this story, and he really thought he was right, as did this female boss of his.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea, though.
Are you going to take questions?
Yes, I just wanted to give the panelists a chance to
I'm good to go with questions.
Yeah, we can just go with questions.
Go to questions?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Sure. In the front row.
So my question to you is, you mentioned culture, our culture, and the human body.
Yep.
It's at this point in time, as I see it, it's here in America that there's such a negative thing toward a naked body. Whereas when you go to other countries, the nudism is honored and appreciated. What is it about our culture that we can do to try to change that concept?
Well, I'm going to be a really obnoxious and say that at the root of it is our American version of Protestantism, which I think at the root of it is our American version of Protestantism that indoctrinates our moral framework and what is appropriate and isn't appropriate. And I mean, the naked body is an attack on culture. And I'm not quite sure why it was so much more acceptable in Europe, except that I think that it's an older culture and they've gone through more upheavals. And we are still working through our uniqueness, the things that made us particular, as opposed to, which, you know, it was a coming together of, you know, a Puritanism and a sense of propriety and respect. Our sense of self-respect is very clothed.
Oh, can I jump in on that too? And I think this may get to another topic of conversation that we can pick up, but I think within this discussion of clothed and unclothed, there's an implicit conversation about class and race, and so class structures, and people who either are forced to or need to make money from their bodies in a way that that requires them to potentially be unclothed.
Yeah.
Or so I think nudity in these images that are in bodies has a lot to do with race, with class, and tied to that with race. And so there is, of course, culture where covered up, and that's the appropriate way to sort of control your body. But using your body, especially as a naked body, really kind of goes along with other kinds of social or cultural issues.
Yeah, but that's because we are so Christian. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to say that.
Don't be sorry. It's not untrue.
Yes. I don't even, I'm not sure how to formulate this as a question, because it's just a feeling and a kind of thought that I'm trying to formulate in my mind. I'm trying to understand myself, I guess, partially through, you know, looking at artwork and listening to what everybody's saying. But one of the conclusions that I'm coming to is that nudity for me, or revealing my unclothed body, has to do with my ability to control what happens to me.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And if I do not give my permission for somebody to be able to view my body, which to me, I'm a sculptor. I love the human body. That's my favorite thing to work with. So it's like looking at it gives me pleasure, not like sexual or anything like that. It's just a beautiful thing for me to see. Mm. So if I withhold that from other people, then I have some control, and who I allow that to is an expression of who I am, who I trust. So, does anybody want to speak to that, or does that ring any bells?
Oh, I should not talk.
No, you can.
Oh, okay. Let me just. I, for a long time had. I think that exposing your body in the arts has. It's a two-edged sword. One, it brings you attention. But on the other side, it brings you the potential of dismissal or contempt, and they're always played together, and so you have to like decide how much you weight it. What are you going to get out of, if you are in control of the fact that your body is naked, then you are clothed, then you are able to say, I will get more from being unclothed, I'm being, you know, in my body than I will from being clothed, and I can live with the negative. But I think it's the difference between being exploited by somebody and doing it yourself is a huge difference. And that's my discomfort, because I can't help it. I exploit bodies. And that was, anyway.
So I actually have a hard time with these conversations because I think they're really complicated in a way that is really hard to get into in this short period of time. So yeah. There are a lot of, especially young women, who use their bodies as ways to challenge this sort of the Christian conservative notion of bodies should be shameful and we don't show them, et cetera, et cetera. So you have things like slut walk, right, mm-hmm. where you have women who are walking around topless or in certain outfits on the streets marching down saying, how dare you call us a slut? No matter what we wear, you're going to call us this, so let's just not wear anything. You have, what was the other one that happened over the last couple
That's
of years?
Great.
See, I don't agree, but okay. I'll explain why in a minute, which is fine, and we can talk about it. There was another one where, whatever, I can't remember it. Same principle, right? Because the idea is, if you're telling us not to do a thing and you're trying to shame us for our bodies, then like, fuck you, we're going to do it anyways. But the problem for me and why I have so much tension with it is that just because we expose our bodies doesn't mean that they don't still exist in patriarchy. Mm. So what happens with slut walk, for example, this was a while ago, but you have all of these women who are walking down the street in whatever, they should feel free to wear whatever they want, and they have men who come out to gawk at them. They didn't challenge any notions of what slut means or doesn't mean. They didn't challenge any notions of what bodies are desirable and what bodies aren't. So I'm not necessarily for example, like, plus size pornography, like, if you're showing a body that is not the conventional body and you're saying, let's find this desirable as well, I think objectification across the board is wrong. So I don't care whether your body is conventional or not. So I say that with the tension of, but how do we bust open these walls at the same time while understanding we're in these systems of patriarchy and white supremacy that dictate what is desirable and what isn't desirable? You were mentioning the big butts yeah. being a thing that has always been fetishized and demonized in black women, right? Like,
right,
we have these old images.
Women.
Well, yes, but also like there's now this sexualization and fetishization of it that is different than it was, but it's still this sort of, it's still coming from this history of like white supremacy and fetishizing these bodies, these othered bodies. The other thing I was thinking about as you were asking your question is street harassment. And I went there because whatever you wear, it doesn't harassed. Matter. You're going to get harassed. So you don't really get to control how people, men, are the ones who are doing street harassment primarily, are the ones who are looking at your body and making judgments and getting to say what they want to say or think what they want to say, regardless of whether you're dressed or otherwise. So to some degree, we don't have control over it because we live in a system that is so male-dominated and so male-centered.
Can I ask you, I would just be curious, in your own experience after that harassment began, how did that change anything about the way you present yourself in the world? Did it solidify you? Did it scare you? I mean, obviously, but I mean,
not in terms of the clothes I wear.
No, but I mean,
yeah, I mean, it took me years to get to the point where it's okay for me to sit on a panel and not be scripted, because I was so afraid of everything I say and everything I do being used against me, because it was. And it's trauma, right? I was living under, I mean, it still is, but I've figured out ways to be human again. Because one of the things that happens when you're harassed or abused in any sense is that you lose your humanity. And we're telling women online to toughen up, to grow a thicker skin, to basically strip away our ability to be human and to have feelings and to react to things in a, I don't want to say normal, because whatever normal means, but in a way in which it is appropriate to react to, which is why my passing comment about seeing those awful images don't affect me anymore, that means my bar has changed. And that's a horrible thing to ask anyone to do. My bar should not be there, right? Mm-hmm. And so over the last couple of years, I have figured out a system that works for me to become more human and disconnect and feel better about myself and the world to some degree, but it's not...
it is very much a trauma, and people react to it by being very vigilant, by being closed off, by, you know, like, I think about where I sit in restaurants in case I get recognized, like that sort of thing.
I have a question for Willow about kind of segueing into women empowerment, how you created Miss Marvel and how you came up with the physicality of her.
So Ms. Marvel, the character that I co-created and the series that I write for Marvel Comics, is about a young 16-year-old Pakistani-American girl from Jersey City who kind of literally wakes up one day with superpowers. She can kind of grow and shrink. She can get sort of Hulk-sized and also very small, or make her fists really big to go fight bad guys. And it got a lot of attention because it was the first time that a female Muslim superhero had been given her own comic book series. That had not happened before. And it was the physicality of superhero comics is something that is sort of a constant topic of discussion in geekdom, because these are heroes who sort of reflect, in many ways, unreachable ideals. They have powers that we're never going to have, or they are the sons of billionaires and they have an IQ of 250 like Iron Man or like Batman. You know, they run around kind of in spandex with their underwear on the outside. Oftentimes they have very idealized bodies, both men and women. You know, they're sort of super buff and very tall and, you know, have wonderful posture, none of which I have. So making this character was a very unique experience, I think, for everyone on the team. Because number one, she's a 16-year-old girl, and we were not going to give her, you know, giant sort of double D boobs and put her in a skin tight costume, a la some of, you know, the other more Amazonian archetypes of women in superherodom. We wanted her whole persona to have a very DIY feel, so her costume to be something that she would put together herself out of things she would have found in her own closet, you know, without the $1 billion foundation of a Bruce Wayne or of a Tony Stark. If you don't know these names, don't worry, you don't have to. Yeah. It's not going to make a huge impact on your life. And so what we ended up with was a hero that very much went against a lot of archetypes about what a hero is and how a hero looks in pulp fiction, in superhero comics. Because she's got the body of a 16-year-old girl. She's not, you know, an adult woman in her 20s or 30s. You know, she comes from a slightly more conservative culture, so we kind of went back and forth, okay, what would she wear, how would she, I mean, she's not going to wear a thong, which is part of the costume of women in certain superhero comics. She's not going to have what is literally in the industry called a boob window in her costume. If you've noticed, you'll see a lot of female superheroes, they have a very normal looking superhero costume with the spandex and everything, and then this totally unexplained cutout right over the cleavage, which is universally referred to and understood as a boob window, and used without a trace of irony. So, you know, it's it was an interesting experiment in sort of celebrating a lot of those pulp fiction, pop cultural ideas about what is possible without sort of pandering to a lot of baggage about what it should look like or what it should be.
It's brilliant. You all should read it. Oh. It's really good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You should just come on the road with me and be my hype person.
I'll do that.
The blues. I think you had your hand up. Yes. Yeah, several times.
Yeah. Thank you very much, first of all, for all the interesting things you've been saying. It's really hard to project without microphones. My question is to everyone on the panel. What do you think about cosmetic surgery within the context of this topic we're talking about?
Jeez.
Yeah.
What is
just stand up. Stand up. Yeah. And say your question to the back of the room.
Yeah. The question is, what do you think about cosmetic surgery within the context of this topic?
I can start. I think that we should not judge women for the choices that they make, and that people make the best choices available to them at the time that they make them. I was on a panel, I was on a panel with Karuna, and she said that ideally we want to change the society in which the choices are made. And I really liked that framing, that like we can have personal opinions about it, but it's not fair to say like, why did you take that role, or why did you like get a boob job, when everything in society tells you to do these things, right? And so I don't think it's our place to judge women about the choices they're making as much as it is to try to create a world in which women are accepted for where they're at that moment in life.
Well, can I also say that men now do plastic surgery with the same freedom that women do, and it's this pursuit of a presentation. You want to be able to present yourself in a way that gives you confidence, and this is a kind of clothing that you can put on. When I was growing up, the big thing was nose jobs. I grew up in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is very Jewish, and the nose was a very, I don't know, it was a really difficult object. It was amazing how many girls I knew had nose jobs. And I don't know if it made their lives better, but it was just something you did.
I would, I don't have a clear answer. I agree very much with the idea that you can't judge women for the choices within that system. It does bring to mind, I just had a conversation with a woman. We're doing a project called Pussy Fest, which is this playwright in New York, and what she does is she pairs up playwrights with an actor, and you meet with them. The topic is the body, the theme is the body. You meet with them, you talk for a little while, and then the writer goes and writes a monologue specifically for that actor to perform. So I met my actor for the first time, a woman named Rachel Lin, Chinese-American woman, and quite a bit younger than me. And so we were talking about a lot of things, and she started talking about plastic surgery and the fact that many of her family members had had plastic surgery to look more American. She started talking about it specifically as an actress and how she felt that the pressures of wanting to do TV and film and be on screen made her tempted to specifically have what she called big eyes. So we were talking about that, and I was approaching it. I could tell she sort of was looking up to me a little bit for my opinion, and I was very much like, I understand the pressures of this industry. I don't think you should have to do that, but if you feel that's something you need to do for work, you know, we're having that exchange. And then she said something that really broke my heart. She said, you know, I got broken up with a year ago from a long relationship, and I'm on my own, and part of me really thinks that if I change my face, then I'll find love.
Yeah. That's so true, though.
And it was so hard for me because I really just felt very protective of her in that moment, and it wasn't such an intellectual thing as just speaking from my heart. And I said, listen, if you change your face for work, you know, then you do what you got to do, but please don't change it to find love, you know, because I just, and then she said, thank you for saying that, but it was just like, that was underneath, we were having what seemed like a very strategic conversation.
Is there a difference, though?
Yeah. Well, I felt there was, because I felt that in our industry, if you're going to work in film or TV, you make a lot of compromises, and you know when you're making them. And I feel that it's different to make those compromises. I felt that she needed to find someone who loved her face, and not, it's one thing to say I'm going to be able to earn more money if I do this, and a different thing to say I can't find a relationship, someone to love me the way I am. To me, that was different, but I could understand it might not be, but for me, I felt very differently when the conversation changed.
What if she doesn't find a relationship?
I just wanted to speak to this topic. Anita, you said and spoke to a lot of us about talking about not judging these women who choose to partake in the culture of plastic surgery. And I want to talk to that more as I've taught my daughter and the women around me that it's not about judging these women and men who choose to do this. It's about questioning. It's about questioning why, questioning the motivation, questioning what it is that you want to achieve with this and why you want to participate in that culture. And so I feel like the judgment against these women who choose to participate in the plastic culture is really more about the dialogue than that comes from viewing these women and men.
Yeah, sure, and some of it is also equipping people with the tools to make informed decisions, right? Like, we want to equip young folks with my host that I'm staying with, we were talking about raising kids, which I love talking about raising kids. I don't have any. so it's great. It's super easy for me to talk about. But it's like, you can't control your children, right? They have their own personalities, and so do you, like, you give them the as many tools as you can so that they can go off and make the right, make decisions that are good for them that they need to make. And I feel like it's kind of that, right? I was sitting here thinking, like, I don't know if I said what I meant to say, because, like, I'm torn. Like, I don't believe in plastic surgery, but I'm also not older, right, in that I'm not in a, like, and I don't mean that in a condescending way. I mean that in a legitimate, like, in life stages, your perception changes. So, like, my teens to my 20s to my 30s now change, and so my 40s and 50s and 60s are going to change as well. So who the hell am I to tell you what your experience is, even though at this moment in time, I think it's awful that we have a society that values appearance over anything else, and that women are disposable when they are over 30, right? So I don't know why I got so aggressive about that. I didn't mean to, but, like, I have a lot of tension with it, because I don't think judgment is inherently a bad thing. I'm a critic. It's what I do for a living. But I do think that we should sometimes separate individuals from the larger systems that inform the decisions that individuals make, right? So, like, why would a woman take that why would Scarlett Johansson take the role that should be that should be cast as a Japanese actor, right? Mm-hmm. Why did she do that? I don't really care why she did it. I care that we live in a system in Hollywood that casts white actors in roles of people of color, right? Like, why did the woman do the horrible sexualization scene or whatever might happen? I don't really care why she chose that scene. We all know why. She's trying to get in. She's trying to, you know, build a career for herself. But what is it about the system that made it so that those are the limited options that she has? And I'm interested in attacking the system. So, but I agree that, like, questioning these things is important.
I mean, there's another thing about plastic surgery. It's a way of becoming standardized. It's a standard commodity. You get go to a surgeon and you get the same nose. You get the same. I mean, you can see a Botox forehead. You can see a facelift. You can see lip enhancement. It's all, and it sort of looks the same on everybody. So there's a way, by choosing to do it, that you are in some ways wanting to be part of a society. And I can't say that that's a wrong thing. I find it curious. I certainly wouldn't want the same nose as my friend next door, but...
Can we spoil Ms. Yeah. Marvel?
Yeah, if you want.
A little bit, just at the beginning. I mean, I just think that the storyline about her trying to become this idealized is really interesting in this conversation.
Yeah, so in the beginning of Ms. Marvel, in the first arc where she is just getting her powers, one of her heroes to whom she looks up is Carol Danvers, who is Captain Marvel in this Marvel universe, who is sort of the archetypal, tall, beautiful, muscular but slender blonde, you know, with sort of, you know, blue eyes and everything is perfect. And at the beginning, Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan, thinks that if I want to be a hero, this is who I need to be. And since her powers involve shape-shifting, she personifies that person, that character, for... It's like a few days at the beginning of the series. Because in her mind, she has grown up in a world in which that is the way that you look if you are a hero. And so in order to be a hero, that is the way you need to look. And it's only sort of through getting to know herself and who she is as a superhero that she sort of discovers, well, yeah, this is freighted with symbolism, of course, she can also heal her body. But in order to heal, she has to be in her true form. So really, in order to be a superhero, she has to be her truest self. So it's an interesting way that we use images sort of symbolically to signify certain things, and how undermining those expectations is actually often a lot more work than it seems at the outset.
So what did you, what was the intellectual process that she went through that gave her that realization and the ability to accept it?
Figuring out that she could only heal when she was in her true form.
Okay.
I mean, this is pulp fiction. We do not deal with sort of PhD thesis.
But like, it's so valuable because you have this plethora of like superhero comics that are all like the same fucking bullshit story, like again and again, and it's all just like punch things and survive, and like there's the identity isn't really there. And so having like a young brown woman who's dealing with identity politics and straight up in the first book is like being a tall blonde perfect model of what society tells me should be is not, like, how cool is that, that like young girls get to go to the comic book store and pick that up and like have someone reflected that seems more real and more true to their experience.
Yeah, well, yeah. Yeah, I'm it's it's always scary when you break those tropes because you don't always know what's going to come out. And so it's been exciting to me to see that that's been the reaction.
And it's been a very positive reaction, too.
Yeah, it has.
There's a hand up back there. I don't know if you can see around the corner.
Yeah.
Or unless we're done.
There's someone over there.
I think, and then maybe the woman in the white shirt after.
You've been forever.
But we haven't heard from anyone in the back yet, so.
I think this is an important thing to throw in, and I find that I feel comfortable having the expertise to speak to this. But I'm really interested in how the trans community is inserting themselves into the middle of this argument in a really incredible and powerful way that's changing people's perceptions of form and gender and the lines that blur those. So whether that's in HB2 and changing the bathroom bill in North Carolina to how we perceive the human body and gender that accordingly. So if any of you want to speak to that in your work or how you feel that is changing these representations, but also I'm totally fine if you don't feel an expert enough to speak to this issue.
I have to say that I've been pretty disappointed at the lack of intersectionality on the panels that I've been on here. Yeah, it's been very white and or at least white privilege, and I feel like trans voices are not visible in this space in which they should absolutely be. And I've mentioned this on other and women of color, et cetera, I've mentioned this on other panels that like I'm really glad you brought it up and like we should hold space for that, but I'm not to out anyone, I am cis, and I can't speak to trans experiences, even though that's such an important piece of this conversation and an important piece of what does it mean to have a body, to have a body of a gender that doesn't, like, when you look at media representations, what do you see and what's reflected back at you and what's the idealization of that? And I think trans voices have a very different conversation around that.
I think that says it.
To follow that up with Amy, what do you see with films in terms of, we have a couple of kind of token trans,
so is it
open?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the beginning. I think Jill Soloway with Transparent did something for that moment totally revolutionary, and I think it's the beginning of hopefully a shift of the paradigms. I feel like it's, I agree with what you said. I can't really speak to it from personal experience or from expertise, but I feel that breaking this conversation wide open about gender is so needed and is going to really blow everyone's minds. Because, I mean, the most recent phenomenon being this actor that's on Billions, whose name I'm blanking.
I don't know the actor, but the character, Taylor, I was like, I've never seen a character like this on TV.
So they have been nominated for an Emmy. And
that's
the
great
conversation that came up was nominated for Best Actress or Best Actor. They wrote a letter asking the Emmys how the Emmys plan to handle that. The Emmys wrote back and said, whichever category you prefer is fine. And that was sort of saluted by a lot of people as this huge step forward. But in fact, we still have two binary categories, which is, you know, what they responded. And I believe they chose actor because the word itself was non-gendered. Yeah. But it was a temporary solution for something that clearly needs to break open.
I just want to plug my shit for a minute. Sorry. So you can find my videos at feministfrequency.com. But in May, we're feministfrequency.com. But in May, we're about to launch a new show that looks at the intersection of current events and media. And we're doing an episode on the bathroom bills and talking about the history of trans representations in the media coming down to present day. If you are interested, subscribe to our channel, feministfrequency.com. Yeah, well, if you go to my website, you'll be able to see it and all those links. Sorry. I'm like, I should just plug my stuff while I'm here.
So the incident and part of our conversation, and I think all of our blogs in one way or another, we're looking at how we're being looked at as women, as having the threat of attack in one way or another. And I'd like to what responses you may have. In the late 70s, as the women's liberation movement was really gaining steam and going into the culture in a big way, it was catching on, I happened to be in a small conference room with three men who had spent 5 months working for one of the big cosmetics companies on a project they hoped would save their butts, which was to how would they change their positioning to appeal to women who were waking up to their want for equality. And here were three highly educated men, one executive and two specialty consultants, had been working for months to try and position a new fragrance that would leave the cosmetics company so women would like them again. And these guys were so motivated, they had so many resources and so much intent to really connect with women. And I got to sit there for an hour and listen to them turn themselves into pretzels after 5 months of working on this, because they were trying to get a handle on what was feminine that they'd never experienced.
Oh, interesting.
It wasn't in their bodies, right? Yeah. It wasn't theirs. And they were lovely guys, and it was helpful. But in the years since, I've reflected that some of the attack, whether it was a couple of centuries ago or now, may come from the fact that they can't quite get a handle on it, but also they can't just allow it to be. And in our culture, we don't have the space for that, I don't think. But I'd love to hear any feedback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we have to get to another panel.
I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I think that, yeah, a lot of, I mean, if you study ancient cultures, there's a lot of fear in patriarchal cultures. There's a lot of fear around the female body. So the idea that that might stem from an inability to see oneself in that body is a nice, I think that's giving a lot of credit to the patriarchy, but I'm sure it's a piece of it. Mm. That would be my response. Yeah. If anyone else.
The thing is, it's an impossible task. You can't, so, but it's...
Unless there was a way to make space for it, right, to just honor it
and not have to. Writers do that. I'm always amazed how writers can transform their psyche from male to female. I have no idea how they do that.
Some better than
others. Huh?
Some more successful.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think we have to move on from here. And so I want to thank everyone, all the audience for coming and the panelists. If you would like to come